Good morning. The title of the lesson today is Exodus 4, verses 18 through 31. As we've done on a couple of different occasions, particularly in the book of Genesis, and we're getting into an area in Exodus where I want to just one more time remind you of a couple of definitions that we've worked with in this class. And those two definitions are two different ways of looking at God's will, two different ways of looking at how He works in history. God's preceptive will and His decretive will. And we've talked about these before, but let me just run through this very quickly for you. Sometimes in life, when we look at the Scriptures and at God's will, it appears that you have two things that are more or less working against one another, when in fact they're not. God's preceptive will is His will that's revealed by the prophets and in the Scriptures. It's essentially God's will in terms of His desire for His people. It affects our behavior. It's what God desires us to do. It has to do with human obedience. God has given man the power, but not the right, to disobey His preceptive will. Human volition operates in the context of God's preceptive will. When God says, "Thou shalt not steal," that is God's preceptive will for part of how we behave. As creatures who make decisions, we can choose to obey or to disobey what God has revealed. But working alongside His preceptive will is His decretive will, those things that He has decreed. God's decretive will refers to those things which He has decreed or predetermined to happen. Man has no ability to disobey in the context of God's decretive will. Human volition doesn't operate in that context. The reason I bring this up is we're going to at least touch on that verse, chapter 4, verse 21, where we read that God hardened the heart of Pharaoh. And this is going to be something that we're going to see over and over in the next 10 chapters. So I want us to remember these two things, and I'll be referring back to this as we go through the next 10 chapters of Exodus, which, as those of you who have been coming to this class know, will not occur today. Last week we left Moses standing at the burning bush. He was complaining about the commission that God gave him to return to Egypt to confront Pharaoh about the Israelites and to deliver that nation from bondage. This is his commission. And Moses is a man who has doubts about these things. You'll recall that he has doubts about his own abilities, particularly with respect to his linguistic skills. But Moses also doubts that when he gets back to Egypt and he addresses the elders and the congregation of the Israelites, he doubts that they're going to receive his message. He doubts that they're going to believe him, even though God has told him that they will. But God's been patient. Last week he gave Moses three signs that Moses will be able to use to demonstrate to the Israelites that his calling to deliver them is legitimate. Nevertheless, he's still less than confident about his mission, and he doesn't really want to have anything to do with Egypt, and he doesn't really want to have anything to do with Israel. God finally rebukes him, sends him on his way with the assistance of his brother Aaron. Aaron's role now will be to serve as a mouth, or we would say as a spokesman for Moses. It's an accommodation God makes to Moses because of his fears. Today we're going to finish chapter 4. Let's look, if we may, beginning with verse 18, and read through the end of the chapter. Then Moses departed. He's departing Mount Horeb, where the burning bush event occurred. Then Moses departed, and he returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and he said to him, "Please let me go that I may return to my brothers who are in Egypt and see if they're still alive." Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead." So Moses took his wife and his sons, and he mounted them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of God in his hand. The Lord said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders which I put in your power. Here it is. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go that he may serve me, but you've refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn.'" Now it came about at the lodging place on the way that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint knife, and she cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet. And she said, "You are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me." So he let him alone, and at that time he said, she said, you are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. This is the kind of thing when you're starting to prepare your lesson, you look at this and you think, oh, I got to explain those three verses. Verse 27. "Now the Lord said to Aaron, 'Go meet Moses in the wilderness.' So he went and he met him at the mountain of God, and he kissed him. Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord, which he had said to him, and that he had sent him, and all the signs, and all that he had commanded him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went on together and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. He then performed the signs in the sight of the people. So the people believed, and when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel and that they had seen their affliction, then they bowed and they worshiped." We begin today with Moses on Mount Horeb. He's leaving there. He's traveled there, as you'll recall, with the flocks of his father-in-law, Jethro, and it was there that he encountered the angel of the Lord in the burning bush. I'll tell you, the last half of this chapter is difficult. It seems a bit disjointed when you look at the events themselves. It seems to lack a lot of the consistent flow that Exodus has had up till this point. It has both some stylistic challenges to anyone who would seek to understand the chapter, and there are some pretty significant interpretive problems that we're going to look at as we go through the lesson today. And I want to start by pointing out just a couple of the stylistic challenges in this chapter. Some go back as far as verse 12, actually. Verse 12 is the verse that reads, this is God instructing Moses, "Now go, and I will be with your mouth, and I'll teach you what you're to say." There, you would think when you read that verse that God's more or less put an end to Moses' questioning. He's told him to go, and he's given him the assurance that when he gets back to Egypt, God will put in his mouth the words that he needs to say. But when we get down to verse 19, and then again in verse 21, it's as though God gives this same command with the same instructions. You get to verse 24, and we have those three verses that contain and describe this strange account of a circumcision and what looks like a near-death experience for Moses. The event that took place at the end. We'll call that the Caravan Motel. I think I've actually stayed at a place named that. That's why sometimes my wife looks skeptically at me when I suggest a road trip. She knows where I might be likely to stop. It comes from years of riding a motorcycle. This account is then followed, the circumcision account is then followed with verse 27, which is the wilderness meeting between Moses and Aaron. The two of them go back together, but apparently without Moses' wife or sons. They just disappear, and they don't show up again until chapter 18, verse 2. When we get there, we'll discover that at some point prior to that, Moses has sent them away. It isn't explained to us in the text. Then the chapter closes with the account of their arrival in Egypt and the response that they get from the elders of Israel. There's a glue, though, that holds this together. Even though it may seem a little bit disjointed, the glue is the return to Egypt of God's chosen deliverer. It's the nucleus that around which these different narratives hold together. In addition to these somewhat odd stylistic things, there are some interpretive challenges. I'll give you some examples. These are just some questions that should come up in our minds as we read this. One is, why did Moses tell Jethro that he's going back to see if the Hebrews are still alive? That's the reason he gives. He's just been commissioned to lead 2 million of them out of Egypt. To say it kindly, is this a false statement? Then there's the translation of verse 19. It can really be looked at a couple of different ways. My Bible, the NASB here, translates this, "And the Lord said to Moses in Midian." In this case, this would be a second command. If we translate verse 19, which says in my Bible, "Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt." If that's how we translate this, then God is giving to Moses a second command to go back to Egypt after he's returned to Midian to the house of Jethro. In other words, the written sequence of verses, verse 18 and then verse 19, and the logical sequence, verse 18 and verse 19, are preserved in that translation. But there's another way you can translate this verse, and the NIV follows the second translation. That is, "Now the Lord had said to Moses in Midian." If you translate that way, and many of you have an NIV Bible, it is taking verse 19 and logically placing it before verse 18. And if you do that, there's an interesting implication. Do you see what I'm saying? If you don't, if you say God said versus God had said, when you say had said, you're putting what God said back further in time. The implication, if we translate verse 19, "Now the Lord had said to Moses in Midian," the interesting implication is that it seems to place Mount Horeb in Midian because it's referring back to verse 12 of chapter 4. That's the verse, again, where God has said, "Now go, and even I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall say." There's another oddity here, verse 19, and it's that phrase, "All the men who sought your life are dead." God has revealed himself in chapter 3 as the all-powerful God. He is the God who is sovereign over men and nations. So why would it be safe for Moses to go back to Egypt only if the people who were seeking his life are dead? Could not God be successful, irrespective of the political situation in Egypt? Then there are these issues surrounding Moses' family. Up till now, we know that Moses has had one son. His name is Gershom. We studied that in chapter 2, verse 22. But when we get to verse 20, the term used is sons. To add difficulty, only one son is then mentioned in the circumcision story. What happened to the other one? More pressing, I think, is the issue of the whereabouts of Moses' family, his wife and his sons, after verse 26, because as I mentioned, they don't show up again until chapter 18. So we have some rather interesting interpretive questions here. Then we come to verse 21, and we have this proclamation, "I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go." And of course, this raises the age-old conflict, the age-old discussion between divine sovereignty and human responsibility that at times can be so perplexing. And finally, there's the question of the reason for the Exodus. Is God delivering Israel from Egypt because they're victims, because they are an oppressed people? Or is there something more fundamental in play? Now, to us, it might seem pretty obvious, but a new theology really has grown up around this question. It's the theology called liberation theology. And the main source text for liberation theology is the book of Exodus. So the question is, why is God delivering Israel from Egypt? Is it to put an end to their slavery? Is that the end unto itself? What's his reason? Or is there something that goes beyond that? Well, let's begin by looking at the text. We'll start our look beginning with verse 18. After his meeting with God, Moses goes back to Jethro, his wife's father. A number of reasons that he probably would have gone back before going to Egypt. For one thing, Moses has worked for this man for 40 years. He's not only his father-in-law, but he's his employer. And I think it's safe to say that Moses has great respect for Jethro and that he sees himself as under the authority of this man. The recognition of and respect for authority is absolutely a virtue that I wish we had more of in our culture today. I once watched a bit from the sidelines as a young woman in a company where I worked, I'll use this term, clawed her way to a job position that she was really unqualified for. She stepped on a lot of people on her way up the ladder. As soon as she got the job, or within a reasonable amount of time, she realized she was not qualified for it. It wasn't as much fun as she thought it would be. It was harder. It required more work than she was willing to give. So one Sunday afternoon, she went up and unlocked the office and wrote, "I quit," on a Post-it note and stuck it on her boss's desk. Now, that's not showing a great deal of respect for authority, but I'm afraid that's the world we live in. But Moses respected Jethro, and he's not going to leave Jethro without informing him of where he's going. He's not going to leave without giving Jethro an opportunity to say goodbye to his wife, or to Moses' wife, Jethro's daughter and grandchildren. And then there's a very practical matter. Moses is out in the wilderness with the sheep. He's got Jethro's flocks out there, so he's going to need to bring those back and turn the flocks over to the responsibility of another shepherd. So Moses has left the mountain. He's now gone back to Jethro's area in Midian, where he has been living for 40-some-odd years. We come to verse 19. "Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, 'Go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead.'" Why does God give Moses this command to leave Midian after Moses has already resolved to go to Egypt? That's assuming this is a second command by God. The question I have is, doesn't verse 19 precede verse 18 logically? And is there not here the implication that Moses can only return there safely, since the king who had sought his death is now dead? Well, the NIV solves this problem. The NIV translates verse 19, "Now the Lord had said to Moses..." It repositions verse 19 logically before verse 18, but it adds the added difficulty that it puts Mount Horeb, it seems, in Midian, because if you're referring back to 4:12, and you say, "Now God had said to Moses," in chapter 4, verse 12, in Midian, remember, he's standing on Mount Horeb when God said that. I don't think that this verse reflects in any way on God's ability to be successful only if Pharaoh's dead. I think this may be a second accommodation to Moses to make Moses feel better about going back and taking his wife and his children with him. Now, in verse 18, Moses told Jethro that he's returning to Egypt to check on his brothers. Why does he do this? Why doesn't he tell the real reason he's going back? Well, here's my answer to that question. I don't know. I have a hunch. The hunch is related to verse 20. Now, I want you to just take a second and picture Moses as he's leaving Midian for Egypt. He's a man with a staff. He has one or two donkeys. He has a wife. He has two children. He has a few supplies and a lot of self-doubt. So do you think someone seeing Moses leave Midian for Egypt would say to himself, "I'll bet that man is heading to Egypt to overthrow the Egyptian empire"? Why, he's on the way to confront Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world, and deliver 2 million Jews from bondage in Egypt. This man and his staff and his donkey and his wife, and his two kids. What a fearsome sight this is. From a human point of view, Moses knew how this was going to look, and he knew how it was going to sound to Jethro, so I think he just wanted to keep his departure as low-key as possible. Verse 21. God says, when you go back to Egypt, you need to perform the signs that I gave you, the ones we discussed last week. Perform these signs. But here's what's going to happen when you do this. I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart, and he's not going to let the people go. Now, if I were Moses, I'd be thinking, what? You've called me to do this? You've told me to go back and deliver these people, and you've given me these signs, and you've given me all this encouragement. And then right before I leave, you tell me, now I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart so that he doesn't let the people go. Well, I want to remind you of a verse back in chapter 3. It's verse 19. There God said, but I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go except by compulsion. Remember that verse? That's a prophetic statement at that point. It's prophetic because it looks forward to something that's going to happen, something that hasn't already taken place. He says, here's what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen. He's not going to let you go. It is a prophetic statement based on God's foreknowledge of how the events in Egypt are going to unfold. And it's given to Moses so that when Moses sees that his initial efforts, his initial work in Egypt fails, he'll know why and he won't be discouraged about it. But then look at verse 21 in this chapter. Verse 21 reads, but I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. I think we have an interesting parallel here between foreknowledge and sovereignty. It's a good opportunity to learn something about this. The reason God has foreknowledge of future events is because all events are subject to the sovereignty of God. God's preceptive will is that Pharaoh release the people. He is demanding a particular type of behavior from Pharaoh. The word of God will come to Moses, and through Moses and Aaron, the word of God will go to Pharaoh, and it is the preceptive will of God, let my people go. Pharaoh, however, has been given the ability, though not the right, to disobey. It's God's decretive will that these events accomplish more than one thing. We've talked about how God is capable of doing more than one thing at once. And there are at least two things going on here. One is, he's going to accomplish the release of Israel from Egypt, but he's also establishing a basis for God judging the king of Egypt and the nation of Egypt. You may recall back in Genesis 15 that we read there when God talked about this with Moses, he said, your descendants are going to be subjects who will be oppressed in a foreign land. And then he said, but I will judge that nation whom they serve. Remember that? So in addition to liberating the Israelites, God is sending, he's setting the stage for a couple of things. One, to judge Egypt through the Exodus. And as we've also discussed, to judge the Amorites and the whole Canaanite civilization through the conquest. So God's setting a stage here. He's not just focused singularly on the Exodus. So when you start to ask yourself the question, why would God, in the revelation of his preceptive will, send a deliverer back to Egypt with a particular commission and then at the same time harden the heart of Pharaoh so that he doesn't obey God's preceptive will? It's because God is doing more than one thing here. He's setting the stage to deliver his people from bondage, but he's also setting the stage to judge that nation that put them under bondage in the first place. When you look at some of these types of things in a vacuum, that is, when you try to isolate them and you get myopic and you just look at one thing and you miss the big picture, It leads to theological error. That's when you start to hear things like, well, the conquest was genocide. Or the Exodus is a sort of reparation for Israel because they were victims of the Egyptian regime, the foundation stone of liberation theology. That's all I'm going to say about verse 21 today. We're going to continue to run into this as we go through Exodus, and I will deal with that more thoroughly as we go through the book. Verses 22 and 23. Here God tells Moses what to say to Pharaoh, and at the same time he introduces a major Old Testament theme, which is the theme of sonship. God says here to Moses, "Say this to Pharaoh, Israel is my firstborn son. Let my firstborn son go so that he can worship me." That's important. Here's the point, Pharaoh. Either Israel is going to serve you, or Israel is going to serve me. Oh, guess what? It's not up to you. This is a major point. See, the Exodus was not just designed to release Israel from bondage. It establishes the basis for Israel's worship. Look at what he says. He says, "Let them go so that they can worship me." It's the basis for Israel's worship. To see the Exodus only in terms of eliminating slavery from an oppressed people is really to limit the significance of what God did with the Exodus. Then God lays out consequences for Pharaoh if he doesn't obey his preceptive will. He says, if you refuse, you don't release my firstborn son, I'll kill yours. It's proliptic. It looks forward to the 10th plague. And in proclaiming Israel as his firstborn son, God is setting the stage for something else we've talked about in this class, lex talionis, the retributive justice, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, bruise for bruise. If Pharaoh won't release God's son, Israel, God will kill the firstborn sons of the Egyptians. Now we come to verse 24, the tough section. Seems to interrupt the flow, and it seems to be a non sequitur. These three verses, by the way, have been referred to as three of the hardest verses to interpret in the Old Testament. The question you have when you first read this is, what on earth is going on here? Well, when you read the verses in the NIV, you would never know that there are monumental interpretive errors. And the reason is that, and I'm not here at all suggesting that the NIV is wrong. I actually think the NIV is absolutely dead on correct. But what the NIV does with these three verses is more of an interpretation than it is a translation, because you can read the NIV and not know that there is, in the Hebrew text, some really significant interpretive challenges. Let me give you a literal translation of the verses, and you'll see what I'm talking about. And I want you to think about the pronouns in this, because pronouns are only meaningful if you know the thing to which they refer back, the antecedent, right? Here is a literal translation. "Now at the inn, a long way, Yahweh met him and sought to kill him. And Zipporah took a flint knife and she cut the foreskin of her son. And she cast it at his feet. And she said, 'Because you are a bridegroom of blood to me.' And he left him alone. Then she said, 'A bridegroom of blood,'" referring to the circumcision. It's not near as clear, is it, as what you read in the NIV. Here are some of the questions. Whom did God seek to kill? Moses or his son? Text just says him. Why did Yahweh seek to kill this person? The Bible doesn't say. Why did Zipporah circumcise one of the boys? Why didn't Moses do it? Why is the word son singular when we know that they now have two sons and that they're both with them on the trip? At whose feet was the foreskin cast? Doesn't say. It says his feet. Was it Moses' feet or the boy's? Was it cast or touched? The word can mean either one. Again, why? What does bridegroom of blood mean? Who left whom alone? Who's the bridegroom? Moses or the son? Assuming the Lord's trying to kill Moses, why would he kill Moses immediately after calling Moses and getting Moses' assent to be the great deliverer of his people, Israel? How is it that Zipporah, a Midianite woman, how is it that she seems to understand more of the theological significance of what's happening here than Moses, the leader of the chosen nation? Well, here are a few, I think, safe assumptions. I think it's a safe assumption that the object of God's wrath is Moses. You see, Moses now has a special accountability to God as the chosen leader of Israel that he didn't have before. God's probably angry because Moses hasn't circumcised one or both of his sons. It's clear that circumcision has something to do with this issue. And apparently, Zipporah's act appeases God, who relents and spares Moses' life. Be helpful, I think, to just review a couple of things about circumcision that may help us to understand this a little better. First of all, the Abrahamic covenant, which we've talked about in this class almost every Sunday for the last 2 years. The Abrahamic covenant is a covenant for which God gave Abraham the sign of circumcision. All Jewish males were to be circumcised on the eighth day. Circumcision has absolutely no saving properties. It was an outward sign of an inner righteousness. And even though it was performed on a child who was 8 days old, it was done in anticipation that this child will respond to the word of God given to Abraham and communicated to the child through his parents, thereby joining together a corporate entity under the covenant, a covenant people that we call Israel. And if a male was not circumcised, the Bible tells us he was cut off from the covenant community. But the most important point to remember about circumcision is that it was not a means of salvation. It was a sign that the individual was a participant in the covenant relationship under the Abrahamic covenant. So with that in mind, here's what I think happened on the trip back to Egypt. Moses, a Hebrew by birth, raised as an Egyptian. I have little doubt that because his parents have exhibited great faith in the Lord in the story of how he was born and how they strategically planned his rescue from the edict of the Pharaoh, I have no doubt that they circumcised Moses. And they did so in accordance with the stipulations of the Abrahamic covenant. Because Moses was circumcised, both he and Zipporah would know of the practice, and they probably had at least some idea about the significance of the sign. But think about it. Moses has been a shepherd in Midian for 40 years. He lived as an Egyptian for 40 years. Then he's lived as a shepherd in Midian for 40 years. He's not living as a Jew. God, therefore, allowed him to be deficient in this thing with regard to his sons. But now Moses has accepted God's call, albeit unwillingly. He's accepted a great responsibility that puts him in a position of leadership of the covenant nation of Israel. So God's no longer willing in his forbearance to overlook this deficiency in what Moses is doing. He's going to be the one to receive and disseminate the law under the covenant. He has to be in concert with what God has revealed in his word to his ancestor Abraham. And you have to understand something about the way people in the ancient Near East thought. They didn't think about secondary causes. Whenever something happened in the world, they made an immediate, straight, solid line to God. So when whatever happened to Moses, and I think it was probably a debilitating illness, Zipporah would immediately look for some spiritual cause or some spiritual deficiency for this, and that is what I think precipitated her conclusion, based on Moses' failure to circumcise their sons, that this was the cause of the problem. So she takes on a role that really should have fallen to Moses, and she circumcises one or both of the sons, and she resented it. She resented everything associated with this act, and so she makes this comment, "You're a bridegroom of blood." I don't know what happened other than the fact that God relents. Apparently, if in fact what was happening here was a debilitating illness, Moses recovers from this. But there was apparently some disunity in the family over this event. And it very likely may be that this is the point in time where Moses sends his wife and sons back to Midian. We don't know that for sure. But I think that's what's going on here. Now, the chapter ends with verses 27 through 31, which is the reunion of the brothers Aaron and Moses. A better translation of verse 27 might be, "Now the Lord had said to Aaron previously, go meet Moses," because when we pick up the story here, Aaron is apparently on his way to meet Moses, and he meets Moses at Mount Horeb. And that's providential. But it's also very appropriate because it was on Mount Horeb that God inaugurated Moses into his new role. And because of the events that occurred there and Aaron's being brought into this situation, Aaron is going to serve as spokesman for Moses. It's appropriate that he would inaugurate Aaron into the truth of his revelation from God at the same mountain. They travel together and they arrive in Egypt, and Aaron gathers together the elders to hear what God is going to say through him and through Moses. I've often wondered about this because we read God had said to Aaron, go meet Moses. You wonder what he may have said to his family. He had to give a reason for leaving. And you wonder if perhaps he went to the elders of Israel and he said, God has spoken to me. I can't imagine that Aaron gets a revelation from God, and he doesn't go to the elders of Israel and say to them, God spoke to me and he told me to go meet Moses. Now, if that's what happened, and we don't know, then I think it's pretty significant that he may have shared this with the elders, because that might create an anticipation on their part, and if not that, a receptivity to the word that's going to come back to them when Moses and Aaron arrive. They would want to know what it is that why God sent Aaron to meet Moses and what it is that God's about to do with the nation. Well, whatever the details that may have occurred here, the people believed, and it's a fulfillment of the promise God had already given to Moses before he really got into all of his complaining back in chapter 3, verse 18. And the reaction of the Israelites is quite significant. When they saw the signs and when they heard the word of God from Aaron and Moses, that God had taken note of their affliction, it says they bowed their heads and they worshiped. What God is doing here is he is forming a basis for the worship of Yahweh anew in the nation of Israel. So the stage is set for the confrontation between Moses and the king, and it's going to take place over the next 10 chapters. Now, we've basically touched on the significant elements in the passage, and I want to take the balance of our time and just mention a couple of things about two of the major themes that are in this chapter. And the first is circumcision. I want to go back to that for a moment. And this actually is interesting with respect to Andy's sermon this morning. Andy, if you were in church, you know that he spoke about false teachers. And yesterday morning, I've been reading through Acts. And I came to chapter 15, which is the chapter regarding the Jerusalem Council. I want you to listen to the first verse of chapter 15. "Some men came down from Judea and began teaching the brethren." Here's what they taught them. Here's the content. "Unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved." That's an interesting verse. Several things here that intrigue me. First of all, As we mentioned, the sign of circumcision was established by God in Genesis 17 with Abraham, not with Moses. And yet the Judaizers say, unless you're circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Circumcision was a sign of the Abrahamic covenant, not a sign of the Mosaic covenant. Now, it applies to Moses. It applies to Israel under the Mosaic covenant. But it is established as a sign of the Abrahamic covenant. The third thing is this. Circumcision was never meant to be a method or means of salvation any more than baptism is a means of salvation. Listen to what Paul says about this in Romans chapter 4, beginning with verse 9. He says, "Is this blessing then on the circumcised or on the uncircumcised also? For we say, faith was credited to Abraham as righteousness." That's a reference back to Genesis 15:6. Abraham believed God, and God attributed that to him as righteousness. How then was it credited? While he was circumcised or uncircumcised? Essentially what he's saying here is, which chapter in Genesis comes first? Chapter 15 or chapter 17? Chapter 15 is where he's justified by faith. Chapter 17 is where the sign of circumcision is given as an expression, an outward expression of that faith. Paul answers the question. It wasn't credited to him while circumcised, but while uncircumcised. And he received the sign of circumcision as a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while uncircumcised, so that he might be the father of all who believe without being circumcised, that righteousness might be credited to them, and the father of the circumcision to those who not only are of the circumcision, but who also follow in the steps of the faith of our father Abraham, which he had while uncircumcised. But by the time of Jesus, by the time of Acts chapter 15, the meaning of circumcision has been distorted. And it was originally a sign of a covenant of grace, it's become an outward symbol of works righteousness by the time of Jesus and the time of Acts 15. And I would be amiss not to point out that if you wanted to look into the Bible and find one of the worst examples of obedience regarding circumcision, it would be Moses. And yet the Judaizers say, unless you're circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you can't be saved. Abraham obeyed quickly. He obeyed fully, and he obeyed willingly. God had to bring Moses to the brink of death, and then his wife, who was possibly an unbeliever, had to take on the responsibility that should have fallen to him. If you think about Acts 15:1, if the Judaizers had said, unless you're circumcised after the custom of Abraham, you can't be saved, the meaning would be real different, because what they would be saying is that they understand that Abraham and we are saved by grace alone, through faith alone. And in a manner simple, similar to baptism, circumcision is an outward declaration of that faith and not a saving ordinance. But long before the time of Paul, before Acts 15, Judaism had perverted the gospel of grace as it was taught in the Old Testament and replaced it with institutionalized legalism. It's interesting to look at Acts 15 in the context of Exodus chapter 4. The second topic I want to just mention in closing today is the idea of sonship. When Christians hear the expression Son of God, it's natural for us to think of Jesus, and that's appropriately correct. But we should be aware that the first occurrences of that phrase, Son of God, didn't refer to Jesus. It was used to refer in Scripture to Israel. In our chapter, verse 22, God said, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. Hosea 11:1 reads, when Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt, I called my son. There's little doubt that that's an allusion back to, by Hosea, back to 4:22 of Exodus. Jeremiah lamented, "How gladly would I have treated you like sons and given you desirable land, the most beautiful inheritance of any nation. I thought you would call me father and not turn away from following me." Again, Jeremiah in chapter 31 says, "I'm a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn." Most of these verses in the Old Testament refer back in some way to Psalm 2, verse 7, where David writes, "I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. The Lord said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you.'" We should understand the word begotten here as a metaphor. God did not literally give birth to the nation of Israel, but he is their source of life. He is the reason for their existence as an elect nation. And likewise, firstborn refers to birth order. And yet, the significance of birth order in the Old Testament is not birth order. The significance of birth order is preeminence. It is birth order that brings about preeminence in the family. So that's really what's in view here. It's a preeminence bestowed by birth order. When sonship language appears in the Old Testament, it usually refers to one of two things, or it's used in one of two ways. It's to refer to God's special covenant relationship with Israel, or God's special relationship with Israel's king. His relationship with Israel is in view in Exodus 4:22. His relationship with the king is in view in Psalm 2, verse 7. God demonstrated his love for Israel by delivering them from the bondage of Egypt, and throughout their history, God sought to treat Israel as his son. This is what Jeremiah is talking about in his book. But like a son, Israel didn't always obey. So sometimes, like a son, Israel had to be disciplined. But discipline was always followed in God's plan with Israel with restoration. And that's the basis on which God will restore Israel in the latter days. Now, the concept of sonship in the Old Testament comes together theologically in the relationship that God has with Jesus Christ, his only begotten Son, because it's in Christ that we see the complete fulfillment of what God spoke about in terms of sonship in the Old Testament. When we refer to Jesus as the Son of God, we're not referring to his birth. In fact, Jesus only refers to his own birth one time in the entire New Testament. Did you know that? Once. One time. It's in John chapter 18, verse 37. He's standing before Pilate. This is the only time he ever says he was born. He says to Pilate, "For this reason I was born." And he immediately follows it up by saying, "For this reason I came into the world." Jesus refers to himself as coming into the world and as being sent into the world. He says this all the time. "I was sent to seek and to save those who were lost. I came into the world. I was sent into the world." One time he says, "I was born," and then he immediately says, "This is the reason I came." As we learn from chapter 3, Christ is the second person of the Trinity, and as such, he is the source of his own existence. When begotten, when that term is used to refer to Christ, it doesn't mean that Christ is the physical progeny of the deity. The link between Israel as God's son and Christ as God's son is evident in Matthew 2, verse 15. It's interesting because the context there, once again, is Egypt. And at God's bidding, Jesus' father, Joseph, has fled to Egypt with his family to avoid an escape from King Herod. Once Herod died and this threat has passed, God instructs Joseph to bring Jesus back into the land of Canaan. And Matthew records this. And in the context of this, Matthew quotes Hosea 11, verse 1. Matthew says, when Joseph brought Jesus back to Canaan, this was to fulfill what had been spoken of by the Lord out of Egypt, I called my son. So in its Old Testament context, it's an obvious reference to the Exodus, but it's cited by Matthew as having a double application. Its Old Testament application is to Israel, but its New Testament application is to Jesus. So it's with regard to Jesus in this concept of sonship where sonship finds its final and fullest fulfillment. Jesus fulfills both the Israelite and the kingly idea of sonship. There are other examples in the New Testament. Matthew 3, after Jesus' baptism, the voice there from heaven says, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased." And again, after the transfiguration, God says, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. Listen to him." So what is applied historically to Israel is fulfilled in the person of Jesus Christ. So that there's not any confusion here, or at least perhaps not as much, let me just very quickly summarize sonship as it refers to the second person of the Trinity. The second person of the Trinity has existed eternally as God's Son. He did not become God's Son. The second person has always been God's Son. Since there was never a time when he became God's Son, there has been a relationship, a Father-Son relationship within the Trinity eternally. This means that sonship is not a mere title. It's not just a role that Jesus fills. It is an essential identity of the second person of the Trinity. Christ has always been the Son of God. This doctrinal position is laid out clearly in the Nicene Creed as early as 325 AD, and it remains the fundamental position of the Orthodox Church to this day. There are other biblical references that we could cite. We could look at Colossians 1:15, where Christ is called the firstborn of all creation. John 20, verse 21, where Jesus declares that his Father sent him, presuming preexistence. Galatians 4, that where we read that in the fullness of time, God sent his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to save those who are under the law. And of course, in Hebrews 13:8, where we read that Jesus is the same yesterday and today and forever. Immutability demands and requires that the Father-Son relationship between God the Father and God the Son has always existed. This is a tough chapter. We've covered a lot of stuff today.